All right, I want you to imagine something for me.
I'm ready.
You're an engineer. You've got a deadline. Your boss wants a solution to some impossible problem. Reduce drag. Harvest water in a desert. Build a skyscraper that doesn't need air conditioning. And you're sitting there staring at a whiteboard, totally stuck.
Relatable. That's every Monday.
But what if I told you the answer already exists? Like, it's been sitting right there, in the woods, in the ocean, crawling around in the desert, for billions of years. You just didn't know how to look.
Okay, now I'm interested. Are we talking about copying nature's homework?
We are literally talking about copying nature's homework. Welcome to ClownCast. Today we're diving into biomimicry, the science of stealing ideas from 3.8 billion years of evolution.
3.8 billion, with a B.
With a B. And here is the thing that wrecks me about this. Of every species that has ever existed on Earth, only 0.1% are still alive. Everything else went extinct. Nature killed off its own failed prototypes. Every organism you see today, every bird, every beetle, every weird fungus, is a survivor of the most brutal quality assurance process imaginable.
So evolution is basically the world's longest-running QA department, and it fires everyone who doesn't pass.
Permanently. No severance package. And what we're left with is this library of proven solutions to engineering problems. Except here's the kicker. There are an estimated 8.7 million species on Earth, and we've only cataloged about 1.2 million. The library is mostly unread.
We haven't even opened most of the books.
Not even close. So biomimicry is a formal discipline. The word comes from the Greek. Bios meaning life. Mimesis meaning imitate. It was popularized by a woman named Jeanine Bennis in 1997. She wrote the book on it, literally. Biomimicry. Innovation inspired by nature. She became the godmother of biomimicry.
Godmother, that's a real title.
That's what they call her. But the practice itself goes way further back. Leonardo da Vinci was sketching birdwing flying machines in the 1480s. Humans have been looking at nature and going, how'd you do that? For centuries. Ennius just gave it a name and a framework.
Okay, so how do I think about this? Because copy nature sounds simple, but it clearly isn't.
Right, so I actually want to use a few different lenses for this one. The first one, and this is the framing concept for the whole episode. You ever play Zelda?
Obviously.
You know the Sheikah Slate, or the Lens of Truth from Ocarina of Time?
Yeah, you hold it up and it reveals hidden platforms, invisible enemies, stuff that was always there but you couldn't see.
That's biomimicry. The solutions already exist. They've been there for millions of years. The kingfisher already solved your aerodynamics problem. The termite already solved your HVAC problem. The lotus flower already solved your surface contamination problem. You just need the right lens to see it. Biomimicry is the lens of truth for engineering.
I love that.
Because it reframes the whole thing.
You're not inventing. You're revealing.
Exactly. And once you put that lens on, you start seeing solutions everywhere. Let me give you my favorite example of all time.
Hit me.
Japan's Shinkansen bullet train. Early models had a huge problem. Every time the train exited a tunnel at high speed, it created a sonic boom, like a literal wall of compressed air that would blast outward. Noise complaints from everyone living near tunnel exits. It was bad.
A bullet train that's actually making sonic booms. That's metal, but also, yeah, problematic.
So the lead engineer on this project is a guy named Daiji Nakatsu. And Nakatsu happens to be an avid bird watcher. This is the kind of detail that changes history, right? He's a bird watcher. And he notices that kingfishers, these little birds that dive from air into water to catch fish, they enter the water with almost zero splash.
Wait, because the problem is basically the same. Air to tunnel is like air to water. You're going from one medium to another at high speed.
Bingo. Same physics. Different context. Nakatsu redesigns the nose of the bullet train to mimic the kingfisher's beak. That long, tapered shape that parts the medium instead of slamming into it. And the results are absurd. 10% faster. 15% less electricity. And the sonic boom. Gone.
Just gone.
Just gone. And he didn't stop there. The pantograph. That's the arm on top of the train that touches the overhead wire. Was making too much noise too, so he studied owl feathers. Owls have these serrated edges on their wing feathers that break up turbulence, which is why they fly silently. He applied that to the pantograph design. Quieter train.
So one birdwatcher solved two engineering problems because he had the lens equipped.
That's the Sheikh of Slate in action. The answers were flying around in the sky the whole time. He just knew how to look.
Okay, but I feel like there have to be more of these. You said nature has 8.7 million species of cheat codes.
So this is where I want to switch metaphors. Because biomimicry isn't just one trick. It's a whole systematic catalog. And the way I think about that catalog is through alimency.
Brandon Sanderson, Mistborn.
Right, in the Mistborn books, an alimencer swallows specific metals and burns them to access specific powers. Iron lets you pull metal toward you. Steel lets you push it away. Tin enhances senses. Gear enhances strength. Each metal is a discrete, predictable source of power.
And you don't invent the power. You discover which metal does what, and then you apply it.
That's biomimicry. Each organism is a metal. It contains a specific, extractable engineering principle. The kingfisher is one metal. It gives you leverag penetration of fluid boundaries. Shark skin is another metal. It gives you antibacterial surfaces without chemicals.
Hold on, shark skin does what?
So shark skin is covered in these tiny tooth-like structures called denticles. And the pattern they create on the surface makes it nearly impossible for bacteria to congregate. Not because of any chemical. Purely because of the physical texture at the microscopic level.
So bacteria just can't get a foothold.
They literally can organize. A company called Sharklet Technologies copied this microtexture pattern and put it on hospital surfaces. Antibacterial protection. No chemicals. No antibiotic resistance concerns. Just geometry.
That's a completely different allomantic metal than the kingfisher one. Different organism, different power.
Completely different metal. And here's another one. The lotus flower. The lotus has these nanoscale bumps on its surface that cause water to bead up and roll off, carrying dirt with it. The flower literally never gets dirty. They call it the lotus effect. And it's been replicated in self-cleaning coatings for car paint, glass, surgical instruments.
So the lotus is the self-cleaning metal.
Shark skin is the antibacterial metal.
Kingfisher is the aerodynamic penetration metal.
Now you're thinking like an alimencer. And the library keeps going. The Stenocara beetle in the Namib Desert harvests water from fog. It tilts its body into the breeze, and these water-living bumps on it shall collect droplets, which then roll down waxy, water-repellent troughs into its mouth. Engineers have copied this for industrial fog-catching water recovery systems.
A beetle in the desert solved the how do you get water when there is no water problem. And someone was like, yeah, let me scale that up to an industrial system.
And then there's the termite mound. This one is wild. The Eastgate Center in Harare, Zimbabwe. This is a real building, a real shopping center and office complex. Uses no conventional air conditioning or heating. None. And it maintains comfortable temperatures year-round.
In Zimbabwe, where it gets over 100 degrees.
The architect, Mick Pierce, studied termite mounds. Termites in that region maintain the internal temperature of their mounds within 1 degree Fahrenheit despite 100 degree swings outside. They do it through this incredibly sophisticated system of convection currents, vents, and thermal mass. Pierce copied the principles. The building uses 90% less energy for climate control than comparable buildings.
90%? I mean, that's not an incremental improvement. That's a completely different category.
That's burning a metal nobody else knew existed. And this brings me to the third metaphor, which is maybe the most practical one. Remember when we talked about mushroom materials back in the fungal factories episode?
Yeah, growing surfboards and handbags from mycelium.
That was biomimicry in action. And there's an actual organization, the Biomimicry Institute, that maintains a database called AskNature.org. And the way I think about it is it's a Pokédex.
Oh, I see where you're going.
In Pokémon, the Pokédex is this massive creature catalog. Every entry has the creature's abilities, stats, type matchups, moveset. You consult it before a battle to understand what you're working with. AskNature.org is organized the exact same way. Except instead of creatures, it's biological strategies. And instead of fire blasts and thunderbolt, it's how does this organism manage temperature, or how does this organism filter water.
So a biomimicry researcher is literally flipping through a bestiary going, I need something that resists bacteria, let me check what creatures have that ability.
That's the workflow. Search by function, not by organism. You don't go, what can a shark do? You go, I need an antibacterial surface, and the bestiary tells you shark skin, cicada wings, dragonfly wings. Here are your options.
That's monster hunter logic too. You don't hunt a Rathalos because you like Rathalos. You hunt it because you need fire-resistant armor.
Perfect analogy. and the battery is growing. The Da Vinci Index, which tracks biomimicry research papers, shows an 11-fold increase since the year 2000. The field is exploding. Biomimicry could account for $1 trillion in global GDP. That's comparable to the entire US oil and gas industry.
$1 trillion.
From looking at bugs and flowers.
From looking at bugs and flowers with the right lens equipped. And it gets wilder when you factor in AI. Machine learning is now being used to scan biological databases computationally. So instead of one birdwatcher noticing kingfishers, you've got algorithms pattern matching across millions of species to find biological solutions that map to engineering problems.
So the Shaker Select just got an upgrade. It's not one researcher with a magnifying glass anymore. It's a computational engine scanning the whole bestiary at once.
And the results are already showing up. Polygon Systems developed artificial roots inspired by aquatic plants that remove up to 98% of microplastics from waterways. Passively, no energy input, just the shape and behavior of root structures, scaled up.
Okay, I'm sold on the concept. But here's my skeptical brain kicking in. Nature also invented parasites. And cancer. And whatever the hell a mosquito is for.
And this is the real debate in the field. It's called the naturalistic fallacy. The assumption that natural equals good. Critics point out that copying nature uncritically means copying its mistakes too. The human eye has a blind spot because the optic nerve is literally wired backwards. Giraffes have this nerve. The recurrent laryngeal nerve. That travels 15 feet through the body when it only needs to go a few inches. Because evolution doesn't write from scratch. It patches.
Nature doesn't refactor. It ships hotfixes on top of legacy code. That's, I mean, we talked about inherited problems a while back. Biological technical debt is exactly what that is.
That's the connection. Episode 142. Inherited problems. Evolution's clutches are inherited problems. Biological technical debt. And if you copy nature without understanding which parts are elegant solutions and which parts are evolutionary duct tape, you'll copy the bugs along with the features.
So the lens of truth doesn't just reveal solutions.
It also reveals that some of nature's solutions are like held together with the biological equivalent of zip ties.
Exactly. And there's another tension. The spider silk problem. We've known for decades that spider silk is stronger than steel by weight. Incredible material. We still cannot manufacture it at scale. Because nature builds things at room temperature, in water-based chemistry, using self-assembly processes that industrial manufacturing can't replicate. You can identify the metal, but not every metal can be burned by human hands yet.
The allomantic metal exists, but we haven't figured out how to metabolize it.
Right. And then there's what I call the replacement paradox. If we get good enough at imitating nature, do we stop protecting it? If artificial trees can sequester carbon, does that reduce the urgency to save actual forests? Some environmentalists worry biomimicry becomes an excuse for ecological neglect.
Don't worry about the rainforest, we copied all its best stuff already.
Which is terrifying. And remember what we explored with the alchemists in the liquid gold episode. The alchemists tried to replace nature, turn lead into gold. Biomimicry tries to copy nature. Same ambition, opposite approach. But the replacement paradox suggests they might converge in a disturbing way.
Copying nature's homework until you don't need nature anymore. That's dark.
It's dark, but the counter-argument is strong too. We've only cataloged 1.2 million of an estimated 8.7 million species. If the library is mostly unread, and species are going extinct before we can study them, then biomimicry actually creates a financial incentive to preserve biodiversity. Every extinct species is a Pokédex entry we'll never unlock. A metal we'll never burn. A lost solution to a problem we haven't encountered yet.
That reframes conservation completely.
It's not just save the whales because whales are nice. It's save the whales because one of them might contain the engineering principle that solves our next impossible problem.
And that brings us to where the field is right now. Chinese scientists recently created a biohybrid jellyfish, a robot made with actual living muscle tissue combined with synthetic scaffolds, nearly indistinguishable from the real thing. We're not just looking at nature anymore. We're starting to merge with it.
Okay, that's simultaneously the coolest and most unsettling thing I've heard in a while.
And Airbus claims that birdwing-inspired designs have enhanced aircraft efficiency by 50% and reduced fuel consumption by roughly 80%. Now, I take corporate claims with a grain of salt, but even half of that is revolutionary.
So where does this go? Like, what's the ceiling on copying nature?
That's the question. Because right now, biomimicry is still mostly observation and imitation. But the next step, and this is where it gets really wild, is not just copying nature's designs, but editing them. What happens when you go from reading the Bashiri to writing the entries?
You're talking about, like, CRISPR.
Gene editing.
I'm talking about synthetic biology. What happens when we stop copying nature's homework and start writing our own biology from scratch? De-extinction. Gene drives. Engineered organisms that never existed before. That's a different episode.
That's the sequel episode. Biomimicry is red nature.
Synthetic biology is rewrite nature.
And the ethical questions get exponentially harder when you go from copying to creating.
Please tell me we're doing that one next.
We're doing that one next, from copying to creating. Synthetic biology and what happens when the Bashiri starts writing itself.
I cannot wait.
All right, folks, that's the episode.
Nature's been running the longest R&D program in history, and apparently we've been ignoring the results for most of it.
Quit the lens. Open the Bashiri. Start burning metals you didn't know existed. The answers have been here the whole time.
As always, we're Clowncast. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Peace.